move very quickly now. We come now to, we looked at the major schismatic groups, the Novation and the Novation schism and the Donatists. You understand what the issues were there? There were dual issues, and I tried to list them for you. We come now to doctrines universally accepted by the ancient Catholic Church. You know what I mean by ancient Catholic Church now? 30 to 323. First of all, the idea of a single Catholic Orthodox Church identified in terms of the writings of the apostles, the traditions of the apostles handed down orally, and bishops in the line of apostolic succession. This idea came to be accepted by the ancient Catholic Church. Secondly, yes, page 60. The bottom of page 60. I come to 61 now. Secondly, the idea of a New Testament canon, and keep in mind that this really came in response to the pressure of what? Of heresy. Because it became an issue when certain alternative books were out. You can see, even today, because of the presence of the Book of Mormon and other false Bibles, we feel a need to go back and restate the reason for accepting the books that we do accept as divine revelation, the reason for rejecting all others. And by the way, you get this in the Introduction to Biblical Studies, do you not? The formation of the canon. So I am not going to deal with that. You can look that over, because this is for the sake of completeness, and if you were doing, well, I think your syllabus would be defective without it. It's defective enough the way it is. So I just put this in. But you will have this discussed in detail in another class. And so I would simply say that the final agreement came in the period 8200 to 400, in particular, the first canon extant, that is, it's in existence, made an earlier, the first canon extant, which is exactly as we have it, was published by Athanasius in AD 367. Now keep in mind, I'll say one word about this, that the Ampelagomena, the question books, the questioning was of the smaller books, and the questioning was only in certain areas of the world. There was general agreement right from the very first. The Vulgate, when it was published, because for the first time you had a good major translation in the Latin, in the language of the West, as opposed to the Greek of the East at this time. But the Vulgate, because it used the number of books settled on by Athanasius, or at least cited by Athanasius, perhaps others before him, it for all practical purpose settled the question. The issue was a dead issue after that. Now, the canon was fixed. And on what basis was it fixed? And I just list this. You ought to know this. It's a good test question. In the long scholarly debate, the grounds upon which the books were qualified for the canon were they had to meet the test of apostolicity. You know what that is? Either written by an apostle or by one in close association with an apostle. Second, content. The character of the book. Third, universality. That is, was the book universally accepted by the church? And the fourth, inspiration. Did the book give evidence of being divinely inspired, such as containing prophecies, things like that? Okay. Come now to the Apostles' Creed. And we have talked about this already in another connection. We've already said that the Apostles' Creed began as a baptismal creed used by the church at Rome. Now, it's very important for those of us raised in the churches of the Restoration tradition to discuss these. People who are raised in denominationalism have a kissing cousin relationship to the Apostles' Creed. Certain churches, they memorize it as youth or parts of it. But we don't use creeds. It's not formally. And so this is sort of new to us, isn't it? We say, what's the Apostles' Creed? Well, it was a baptismal creed used by the church at Rome. It's been amended over the years. We recall that it's the first... The primary purpose, or the purpose of the creed in its original form, was to weed out the Marcionites. I believe in the one God, creator of heaven and earth. It was to weed out the heretics. That's the purpose of creeds. There are references to it as early as A.D. 150, but the exact form is not known. You follow me? It was constantly amended, changed. It was thought of as not having been written by the apostles, but by representing the apostolic tradition. We've already said that. The creed in its present form, by the way, dates from the 8th century. You know that? In its present form, it dates from the 8th century, and you have a copy of the creed in the back. In the West, the church has accepted Tertullian's formula. That's all I have to say about the Apostles' Creed. We're going to look at the Apostles' Creed, by the way, when we look at, again, another connection. We're looking at basic ideas or doctrines accepted by the church. You see what the flow of our thought now? That is, the ancient Catholic, the idea of the single Orthodox Catholic Church, the idea of New Testament canon, the Apostles' Creed. Next, in the West, yes.
We talked about the ancient Catholic Church, and then
the
on us 323.
323, right.
Okay, then
the ancient creed of the ancient Catholic Church.
The original church started in the first century, did not believe in some of the things on us 323, right?
Well, you see an evolution. Ideas which were, they didn't have the Apostles' Creed, for instance, of course, the Apostolic Church. One of the questions you keep asking, where is the New Testament church in all this? Is that what you're asking?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the New Testament, if nowhere else. Very difficult to identify. It's very difficult to go back. You see, groups which were not associated with the official church were difficult to identify. And it's very difficult to practice. Psychohistory is a very tenuous, unpredictable, unsubstantiated science. Now, by psychohistory, I don't mean as Isaac Asimov meant psychohistory in the Foundation Trilogy. I mean psychohistory in the sense of going back and saying, this is what people believe, this is what people thought. Very little evidence. So, we're still looking at what is traceable in history, the main line, the main ideas. And very perplexing question. In the West, the Church has accepted Tertullian's form of the Trinity, not in the East. And I point out that there was no acceptance in the East, and they struggle with this later. This will come in our next section. I refer you back to our discussions concerning the thinking of the Church regarding baptism and the Lord's Supper. We've already talked about that. I just make a reference to it here. We won't reintroduce that topic. Concerning the second coming of Jesus, interesting. In the first century, the Church systematically looked for the immediate return of Jesus. I'm convinced that the Apostle Paul himself thought Jesus was going to come back before his lifetime. He seems to be saying that. And I'm not surprised that the Apostles had no idea when Jesus was going to come back, because if Jesus was speaking about his second coming in Matthew 24, which I think he was, he said he himself did not know. As the period of the ancient Catholic Church dragged on, the expectation progressively diminished. Just in the nature of things, it would. And many of the early church fathers believed that Jesus would set up a 1,000-year physical reign on earth. Premillennialism, not dispensationalism, we discussed these distinctions in eschatology class, so I won't get into them here, but premillennialism, in the sense that many of the early church fathers expected Jesus to set up a 1,000-year reign as an extension of the church, well, it's a very old idea. It was universally held. An old idea. A lot of ideas are old. Well, we come now to discussion 12, and this is the last discussion in this section. This brings us to the end. And I think it's very important. I wish we had a lot of time to spend on this, but we'll move rather quickly. First of all, the morals and ethics of the ancient Catholic Church. We're looking at their doctrines. What about their morals and ethics? Well, first of all, we have noted that the superior life of the Christians vis-a-vis paganism was used again and again by the apologists. This is a real testimony. The Christians lived superior lives. They repudiated such amusements as the theater, circus, events in the arena, because two basic reasons. First of all, they were cruel and immoral, terrible, terribly perverse. Secondly, the activities were religious festivals, involved sacrifices to the gods, kind of like they play the national anthem. Today, they would make sacrifices to the gods, the games, and so Christians objected to that and would not participate. And they were called haters of the human race. You recall our discussion of that. They repudiated holding public office and military service. Holding public office involved swearing allegiance to some of the gods, and for this reason, perhaps other reasons, they would not hold public office. That's a real question today. Should Christians, it's being debated today. Should Christians hold public office? You know, and what about some offices, you see? Should the Christians serve on the government's alcoholic commission, the alcoholic beverage commission? Can a Christian hold public office? Yes.
Could that be what binds James when he does not take oath?
No, I don't think so. No. I don't think so. I think he's just talking about the more informal kind of oaths. That's a real issue, and it's faced it back then. For instance, now they had an issue. We don't have to swear allegiance to a god, but for instance, what about being in a public office that requires you to lie? And some do. You work for the CIA, but you have to lie. Well, it's a real problem, isn't it? It's a real issue. And by the way, of course, Inge probably tells us about this, and it's a real problem that I don't know what the answer is, but for instance, the art of diplomacy. Sometimes it's the art of not telling the truth exactly. You know, saying what is supposed to be said, not true. Sometimes you have to, what is required is that you say you follow the conventional wisdom, whether it's really true or not. And it's not just that. You know, what about the State Department, for instance? You know, regularly they'll issue one statement, and everybody knows it's not true. What do you do, you see? It's not easy, is it? So we just abandon it? Do Christians abandon it? Well, I don't know all the answers. I'm simply saying it's an old problem of Christians holding public office. Now, some of them we're having trouble with. But what about other offices? Can the state become so corrupt that the Christians set the back office so I can't participate in it? And I think there are differences between modern America and ancient Rome. You know? So it's not, I'm not condemning it. I'm simply saying it's a question, it's a problem. All the early church fathers who spoke on the subject were pacifists. Doesn't mean all the Christians were, but the basis of their opposition to war was the love ethic and optimism. They felt that the best way to stop war is to refrain from fighting. Celsus argued that if all men felt this way, the empire would fall to the barbarians. And he was right, by the way. Celsus was an intellectual critic. And we're going to see a change. We're going to trace this later on. We're going to see as we pursue this that the church was pacifists. But you've got to understand that, first of all, the Roman state was very pagan, very cruel. War was very cruel, but war was always cruel. But we're going to see later on that the pacifism went out the window. Let me put it this way. Pacifism works. Well, pacifism is convenient only as long as there are enough non-pacifists to protect your right to be a pacifist. The pacifism is convenient only as long as there are enough non-pacifists to protect your right to be a pacifist, is what I said. That is, you have American pacifists that who march against the arms race, the expansion of the military. Well, it's pointed out to them that they have the right to do that only because others aren't pacifists. Protect them. Protect their right to be pacifists. A real pacifist, by the way, is the one who is willing for himself and his loved ones to die rather than resist at all. That's the true pacifist. I don't mean true pacifists around. Even back in the 60s, the pacifists, they would march for pacifism and they would demonstrate and they would even set fire to buildings for peace. But when it came time for them to be arrested, they would just fight and kick and they would object and they would take it to court. Oh, that's cheating. If you're going to be a pacifist, you got to take your medicine. It's like if you're going to practice non-resistance, then don't ever call a policeman. If somebody's breaking into your house, stealing your property, or raping your wife, you can't ever call a policeman. Because the difference, you follow me? Because all an army is an international or a national police force. There's not very many pacifists around. By the way, pacifism has never worked. It's never been a sustaining view, except where there were enough pagans around to protect the pacifists. And the church, the historic church, changed its view. We're going to see that. I'm not saying right or wrong. I'm simply saying this is how it worked. By the way, the closest you're going to find, I'm looking ahead now, the closest you find to true pacifists, those who are willing to, for themselves and their wives and their children, to die rather than resist at all, total non-resistance, were the Anabaptists of the 16th century. They did it. But nobody else ever has. Well, you make what you want of that. That's the fact. There is no record of a Christian serving in the army until about AD 175. But the Bible doesn't condemn that. For instance, when the soldiers asked John the Baptist what they should do, he didn't say he quit being a soldier. He said he content with your pay. And the Bible, Romans 13, says that those who bear the sword are ministers of God. The Bible doesn't teach pacifism. The early church, all we're saying is the early church fathers who spoke on the subject were pacifists. And they seem to have had great influence. The evidence is not complete. Any questions on that? You see what the issues are in the RNO? Well, very complex. After Constantine, when it fell to the Christians to defend the empire, or let it fall to the barbarians, the church developed the doctrine of the just war. We're going to see four major doctrines of war as history develops, but first of all, you follow me? They went from pacifism to the just war. It's okay to fight defensively and reluctantly. Augustine developed that, by the way. The just war. Well, slavery, what about it? The church did not condemn slavery as absolutely wrong. They realized, as I point out, that it was less than ideal. But you've got to understand that no one could conceive of civilization without slavery. Let me show you an analogy. It would be just as impossible for people of the first century to think of, only to conceive of civilization without slavery, as it would be for us to conceive of civilization without oil. The church stressed brotherhood within the church, but it did not wage a public campaign against the institution of slavery. The ethic of Christianity ultimately destroyed slavery, but it took it a long time. You had slavery up through the Middle Ages, you know that? You had slavery right through the Middle Ages. So the ethic eventually destroyed slavery, but the church did not crusade against it. Right or wrong, the church didn't. Paul, for instance, he was writing to Philemon. If you take Paul's teaching to the logical conclusion, Philemon would have to release to emancipate Onesimus, but it's not required. What about the family? Well, the early church was much concerned with chastity. That is, by that I mean sexual purity, fidelity, chastity, sexual control. Was simply not expected of men in society. There were few one-woman men. I've already talked about this, have I not? This is the background, have I? This, by the way, is the background, of course, of the statement in Timothy. The qualification for an elder, it says husband of one wife. That's not what it says in the Greek. It says one-woman man. And it's always applied to divorce. It says nothing whatever about divorce. If a divorced man is disqualified, he's not disqualified on the basis of husband of one wife or one woman man. It's simply in Roman society, the idea of a man being faithful to one woman was simply not expected. Not expected in many cultures today. Not expected in Japan, by the way. 1 Timothy. The qualifications for an elder, you can look it up, one woman man. I don't know. I don't know what you're asking. Heist, you mean? Heist. I'm not prepared to answer that. I know the distinction, but I don't recall what it is. The word heist is the Greek word for one. Heist, me, a hen. One Lord, one faith, one baptism. Anyway, what I'm saying is that the idea of being a one-woman man, we're not talking about divorce. We're talking about a man who simply slept with his wife and no other woman. It was not expected. By the way, the statistics are that over half of all American husbands do not think it's expected of them. You know that? Over half of all American men are unfaithful to their wives. And with many, and you ever work somewhere? I've worked with men in the factory. I've worked, you know, in the factory, who thought it was, who, if you said, if they found, if a man ever said, "I sleep with my wife and I sleep with no one else," they didn't believe him. There were men like people like that. They said things, they're lying. It's inconceivable to them. Well, that's the way Roman society was. Oh, as I started to say, in Japan, that's the kind of society you have. They don't, it's not, in many other societies in the world, it's just not expected of a man. In Israel, for instance, it's not expected of a man to be faithful to one woman. Well, what I'm saying is that the church said no. The church reversed that standard and said you must be faithful to one woman. What I'm saying is that in the qualifications for an elder, it says a one-woman man. What he's saying is to, in 2 Timothy, to be, here's a man who sleeps with his wife and no one else's wife or no other woman. You know, I'm talking about divorce. Now, the qualification for divorce might come into the question of ruling his household well and this other, but it doesn't come in there. You understand what I'm saying? Well, that's just how they thought. So the church emphasized sexual purity, chastity, sexual fidelity, which is radical. You understand? That's all I'm saying. The church elevated women. That's a whole discussion in itself. The divorce was stringently opposed. The Roman Catholic Church has preserved a strong stand against divorce. The Roman Catholic Church, by the way, is right. Four children were protected. The church was the first to take a stand against exposure. You know what that is? Exposure. Did I discuss that? They didn't want a child to leave it out to die, but it usually wouldn't die. It'd be, if it was not defective, it would be raised to be a prostitute or raised to be a slave or parent or childless couples would take them. Many of them died, especially girls. The church took a stand against abortion, which was widely practiced, and the church took a stand against child abuse. The church needs to take a stand against it today. Abortion and child abuse. Pagan society did not have a high view of children. By the way, should we think of this? The idea of a cute little innocent child to be protected and loved and cuddled and bounced, that is not universally accepted. It was not accepted by pagan society. You know, everybody loves a baby. Not true. Not true. And the church was the first one to protect the kids. It was back to what Jesus said. What did Jesus say? Be careful how you treat the children, because they always, what he says is, paraphrase, yep, they always have the attention of God. They'll tell God on you. They always have the faith. They always behold the face of the Father. What he says, that means they always have the attention of the Father. Their angels do. The concept of guardian angels, which I think is a biblical concept. Careful about the kid. Well, the church took this to heart. And it was the church who stood up for the kid. Social service. There was little or no concern about the sick and the poor in paganism. You go to, you see parallels to this or analogies. Go to India, where you have ancient religions. People can starve to death on the streets. Do they care? See, there weren't any orphanages or schools or hospitals in India, not what it would be called, public schools, until the Christians came, the missionaries came. They're the ones who built the railroads, and they're the ones who built the orphanages, and they're the ones who built the hospitals. Who built the leprosariums? Did the Buddhists build them? What about the Hindus? No. Christian. Yes. No, talk about Roman pagan society. The Jews had a tradition of caring for the poor because of the Mosaic law. See, the Romans were mainly stoic in this philosophy. You know, we don't want to mess with faith. If this guy's sick and starving and dying, that's what it's supposed to be. Don't mess with faith. It's unnatural. What's supposed to happen, it wouldn't happen. Determinism, fatalism, which is the same thing of Hinduism and Buddhism, different from different directions. Fatalism, any kind of fatalistic, deterministic philosophy or religion will eventually get around to rejecting the poor, the sick, the starving. Benevolence was given great weight in the early life of the church. What was one of the first big issues in the book of Acts is what? Care for the widows, the Hellenistic versus the more Jewish widows. Almsgiving to Christians and non-Christians was
very, very big part in the early church, care of orphans and widows. Remember what James said? This is a sign of pure religion. Care of prisoners and captives. By the way, in those days, see, a prisoner or captive, very common, more common than today, to have a prisoner or captive is not a hardened criminal. You could be a prisoner because of a debt, and it was a very unfair society. For instance, remember James talks about the rich oppress the poor. It's very, very common for, there was the idea of a judge who was not bribed, just unheard of. It was like a man staying with one woman, being faithful to one woman. Remember when Paul was before Felix, even these high governors, why did Paul end up staying in jail? Because a bribe was expected. Felix thought he was going to get any money. So when you have a system like that, then you very often find people who were prisoners, who were in jail, not because they were a criminal, but because they were poor. In any corrupt society, for any number of reasons, that's a sign of a corrupt society. The burial of paupers, when poor people would die on the streets, or they'd be hauled off to the garbage dumps. The Christians, interesting. Every morning, the Christians would go out the streets of Rome and major cities and pick up the poor people, Christian or non-Christian, take them out and give them a decent burial. It's just like they would every morning visit the place where the babies were exposed, pick up the babies, take them and raise them. That's quite good, isn't it? Hospitality of travelers was a big thing in the ancient world. It's before the holiday inns were built. And the Christians were known, the word spread among the pagans, if you want to get good hospitality, just ask for the Christians. You know? Even if you're not a Christian, they'll ask you in, treat you right. It's a very important way to show the concern of Christ in the first century world, or one of the early Christian centuries. Assistance to sister churches, we see this in the book of Acts, do we not? The Macedonian and Achaean churches assisting the Jerusalem church. Great deal of, and I like to see this. I'm glad to see this among churches. You know, here's a church that's having trouble. Other churches would pitch in. New church getting started. Let's go out and build a building for them. Helping one another. Real spirit of community. Comes to methods of finance. How are the social services financed? Interesting. The collection was taken at the Lord's Supper. The tradition that we have of having collection in connection with the Lord's Supper goes all the way back to the beginning. Because the communion was considered a great encouragement for generosity. Here's not today. In fact, I think this last Sunday, the man who prayed at the offering said, you know, we've just remembered what Jesus has done for us, and now we have opportunity to do something for him. And this connection between the giving that God did of his son and our giving was made right from the very beginning. Very old tradition. Other free will offerings were taken at various services, and they were administered by the deacons. Much the same way they are today. Yes. Yeah, anything was going on. They were simply, a need would be noticed, people would give. Christians were known for this. They kind of, remember the book of Acts? They did not consider what they had as being their own. We've lost a lot of that. We're very materialistic. But the idea for Christians without others, well, see Christians selling property and giving to other Christians. The church was known for this. Now, it wasn't communism. Remember what Peter said, while you had it, it's still yours, you do whatever you want with it, no obligation. Free will giving. The dignity of labor. The institution of slavery had destroyed the dignity of labor in traditional Roman thought. You see a comparison to this in white Southern America. The idea of the gentleman, and we'll see this in Europe later on, the idea that only a peasant or a slave actually works with their hands. A gentleman, for instance, a gentleman never has calluses on his hands. By the way, this is where the tradition of white gloves came from. Tuxedo or gentle dress, the evening dress with the white glove. Why? See, for the same reason the ancient Confucian nobility would let their nails grow. Do not do manual labor. That's why in the French Revolution, the peasants had a very convenient way of knowing when the peasants revolted. They had a very convenient way of knowing who to execute and who not to execute. They didn't have any calluses on their hands, taken to the guillotine. And by the way, you know, in European, well, this tradition goes. Many societies have had this. As I say, even in white Southern America, you had, for instance, the white landed aristocracy. What did they call the white man who had to work with his hands? This is where the term trash came from. He's white trash. Why? They say he has to work. If a white man did this, had on was so poor that he had to do the labor that the black slave did, then he was trash. He wasn't really white. He wasn't really. He was something between a black slave and a white man, but he wasn't truly white. A truly white man, they thought, did not do field labor. His hands were, he might ride around on a horse and supervise it, but he would never actually get down and dig in the dirt. Well, this recurs throughout societies of different ages, and it was very much a part of the Romans. You had the Romans who lay around and were illiterate and stupid and cruel, but it would not work. Why? They are not a slave. Well, the church changed all of that. What did Paul say to the Thessalonians? A man will not work. Don't let him eat. And Paul says, don't steal anymore. Rather, labor with your hands. And to many Christians who came from the Roman nobility, that was a hard saying. So the church began early to restore the dignity of labor, working with your hands. The church did much to abolish beggary. You've got to understand that in Rome especially, but in the major cities of the Roman Empire, these were welfare states, vicious welfare states. So the people demanded their daily bread from the state. And the church did much to abolish it. I think that's healthy, yes.
How would they do that? In other words, would they help the paupers?
Yes. They did it through teaching. And through teaching and example. They wouldn't refuse. They would not refuse, a pauper. But they had one of their own ranks who was just lazy, living off the church. They'd say, no, you work. Because Paul had said this is what was taught. Man won't work, won't lay meat. Because we've already talked about many tried to live off the church. They found these people would be kind and generous. The tendency to asceticism, and we've already talked about this in a number of ways. The Greek philosophical idea is the physical world is inherently evil, influenced in a progressive way the ancient Catholic Church for the idea of salvation through mortification of the flesh. The idea we're going to get tired of, probably already are. The result is an emphasis on fasting, voluntary poverty, celibacy, and the holier life. The withdrawal from public life, anticipated monasticism. We're going to talk about that as we go along. By the end of this period, by 323, some sections of the church promoted the idea that it was better if the clergy didn't marry. There was a tendency toward legalism. Too often Christianity was spoken of as a new law, and there arose the concept, which became very deadly as it evolved through the centuries, the concept of a higher and lower morality. Still with us today. We've never gotten rid of this. It starts back in this early period. Do not find it in the Bible. The Bible says that God is no distinction, that there is no distinction of persons of God. But there was the lower morality which was required of every Christian. There was the higher, those things which were not required for salvation, but which, according to Tertullian, granted extra merit. You recall our discussion of that, when a person did more than was necessary. And by the end of this period, there had risen the concept of the works of supererogation, that is, more than was required for salvation. The higher works, the higher morality was required of the clergy, works of perfection. And by the way, it was based upon the sayings, the teaching of Jesus. This was the beginning of monasticism. We said to the rich young ruler, if you be perfect, go your way and sell what you have and give to the poor and come follow me. And so through a misunderstanding of this and through for other reasons, they developed the concept that there are first and second class Christians. There are the clergy, there are the laity. The laity are those primarily who keep the minimum standards of morality, but if you want to really be a real Christian, a higher Christian, then you must submit to the higher morality. Very old idea, and I say it's around today. Isn't it true that most people in the church expect the preacher to live a higher life than the ordinary Christian? Generally expected, isn't it? What others do, the preacher can't do. Why? Well, he's a preacher. Where do they get that? They get that idea. Look at that idea. The elders can't do some things that others, that ordinary Christians can do. Where did that come from? Did it come from the Bible? Oh, no. It came from this legalistic approach to Christianity. It came from this tendency to legalism. And we're going to see it. We're going to watch this evolve as we continue to trace the history of the church. We'll leave it now. It comes to disciplines. What was to be done with those who fell below the standard of the lower morality? You got that? You had this minimum morality, which is required of every Christian. But what about those that didn't even come up to that? What about those that couldn't even be this the laity? What about those who committed the unpardonable sin? And the early church declared unpardonable sins, that the unpardonable sins were idolatry, murder, and fornication. Well, the Bible didn't teach that, but this idea came into the church early. Early, I mean, in this first 300 years. Although there was a greater concern about this in the West than in the East, as I point out here. In the West, there can be traced three stages in the evolution of thinking concerning discipline. And I'll just mention it very quickly. Period 1 to A.D. 130. Here was the idea of discipline. You understand what I'm talking about? Those who fell below the minimum standard, that did not come up to the lower morality. Their position was this, A.D. 130, that God forgives sins without, God forgives sin without human mediation, but there are sins which lead to excommunication, which the Bible does teach, by the way, doesn't it? That's biblical. Excommunication is final. The Bible doesn't teach. The excommunicated might attend services as catechumens, but they could never be accepted as a full member of the church again. They're very strict about this. But you've got to understand that the early church was fighting. The church in this period was very strong on discipline for the simple reason that it was fighting for its very life against paganism in every shape and form. By the way, one of the reasons why the church today is not so interested in discipline is that there's not all that much difference between the moral man, the moral secular American, and the Christian. You have to look close to see the difference. Their lives are not all that different. That was some people. Isn't that right? But you've got to understand that the church was trying to survive in a cesspool. What do you do if you're floating in a cesspool and your boat's leaking? The answer is you keep it bailed out. Right? You keep them out. And so if people fell far short, they practiced fornication, adultery, murder, they would put them out, never let them back. Not fully back. Right or wrong, this is what it is. And of course, my opinion, I think we've gone too far the other way. We just do not practice church discipline. When's the last time you've ever seen church discipline really practiced? Some churches, never. We still let it slide away. But anyway, there was in period 2, AD 130 to 217, there was great pressure created by the persecution. And persecution, as we saw, raised problems with this. Remember the Novation and Donatus schisms? You let people back in. In response to the pressure created by persecution, there arose the idea that gross sins, such as apostasy, could be forgiven once. That is, you would get a second chance. The first chance to become a Christian, if you committed a gross sin, like adultery or apostasy, you gave in under the pressure of persecution, then you could get back in once. You see, but understand these persecutions would hit in waves, these sporadic persecutions. So if you gave in and denied Christ, cursed Christ, and burned incense to Caesar, you could be forgiven that once. But the next time you couldn't. No third chance for anyone. Restoration was rigorous, involving public confession of sins, re-education, penitence, fasting, marital abstinence. They really... But, you know, the Bible says, restore such a one, they restored him. They didn't just let him back sneak in the back door. It's public confession of sin. I had a friend of mine who was attending a service held by Clarence Greenlee, preacher at Grundy. Old Clarence, so he had to restore somebody. This old boy who had every revival meeting, he'd come up and repent, you know, rededicate his life, and then 2 weeks later, he's right back where he was, out drinking and carrying on. Here he came again. No, you ever hear Clarence Greenlee speak, old gravel voice, great preacher. He said, and my friend was in the service, said, old Clarence got him up there and said, Charlie, he said, we're going to restore him now. He said, you're the sorriest excuse for a human being I've ever met in my whole life. You're just kidding. And it went downhill from there.
this guy, you know, restoring him. He said, and he just read it right in the riot act. You do this, and you go out and you run around your poor little old wife, and you drink up the grocery money, and this is the fifth time since I've known you, you come up here, and if you don't mean it, go sit down. I mean, he's just talking to this great big old boy. There's old Clarence just talking to him like a dog. I mean, just tearing him to pieces. This old fellow found tears running down his face. Yes, right, Preacher Greenleaf. That's right. You're right. I did, And he asked him later, said, did it take that time? He said, no. Nah. He said, he fell back in, so I just took him and baptized him again. So he's been okay ever since. Anyway, you ever seen it? Ever seen anybody restored like that? That's how they would do it. And by the way, I think that's right. Boy, they got up there and just a public confession of his sin. And old Clarence was publicly confessing for him. He was confessing old Charlie's sin. Just really giving a sin. I don't know if it was his name or not, but we just don't do that. We don't have the courage. You know, we don't want to lose him, man. We don't want to lose him. Well, period 3, to AD 17 and following, Calixtus, the Bishop of Rome, claimed the right to forgive sins as a successor to Peter, and we've already been introduced to this, even the worst sins. Tertullian objected that only the church has this right. The church consists of the people in the church who are spiritual, not the bishop in particular. This idea, which was later accepted, was a bombshell. It raised a strong objection. We've always seen it in the Novatian and Monetist, in the Novatians, the Monetists, the Donatists, these heresies and these schisms. It was a real issue of, you understand what I'm saying? We've seen this again. It was not simply the question of, can these people be accepted? But who has the right to say? Can the bishop arbitrarily say, I accept you back into the church? Does the congregation not have to have a voice in it? And can the and it's one thing for the bishop to say, I allow you back into the congregation. And that was debated. Did he have that right? But then when he comes and says, I forgive your sins, that's a whole other issue. Does he have that right? It's one thing just letting him back into the church. But something else to say, I forgive your sins. You know, the whole absolvote, what the priest says. I absolve you. Can he do that? Well, they started trying it in this period, in the period of the ancient Catholic Church, before 323. But when they did it, it raised a storm of controversy. You understand the issue? There were several multi-issued problems. Well, let me finish with this. In the year 251, Bishop Cornelius took a second step in the evolution of the concept introduced by Calixtus. After the first systematic persecution broke out in AD 250, I point out here, many denied Christ under the fear of torture, but quickly repented. It begins to be accepted that the church can forgive sin through the bishops who are the church. And you recall we've discussed that before, just introduced it. Who is the church? The bishops are the church. But did I not say that the Roman Catholic concept of the church is the Bishop of Rome and those who are in fellowship with him? The bishops are the church. And so, a parenthetical summary of the ideas of discipline is this. The church, and these are accepted by the church by AD 250. Number one, the church alone can interpret Scripture. The church alone can forgive sins. The church alone can bestow grace. By the church, they mean the bishops. And by the way, this controversy has always gone on. You see, and I'll just say a word about this and we'll close. You see, and it still goes on today. What is the church? Is the church made up of the spiritual people, or let me word it this way. Just how unspiritual, how unfaithful, how unchristian, if we use Christian as an adjective, which it isn't, just how unchristian can a person be and still be a part of the church? And just how many nominal Christians, how many basically unfaithful, undependable Christians, unconcerned, unspiritual people can the church have and still be the church? Is that not a question? By the way, I heard there's a big debate going on among the leaders of our brotherhood. There are some who say we keep the standards strict, and the church, if you keep the standards strict, the church stays small. If you lower the standards, it's easier to build a big church. You understand that? If you
It is, by the way. If you don't, the less you require people, the easier it is to keep them. So here's the question. Do you have a big, diluted church or a small, pure church? Now, many would deny that you have to choose between the two, and I think if you really preach the gospel and teach well, you don't have to choose between the two. So I'm not saying that that's the choice that we have to make. I'm simply saying, in the light of the kind of preaching that goes on, that is the choice that is often, in fact, made. And many are recognizing this, and it's being debated quietly. What do you think about that? For instance, you get this church where, I know, if you say an elder really has to face up and meet the...